to the second hour of
We the People Radio.
We are here on April 27th, 2025. Guarantee you we are going to play the show again in the future. But our guest is Robert Tannenbaum, and he has written a book. He's written a bunch of books, actually, a zillion books, and 33 to be exact. This one that we've been discussing kind of the surrounding data for, the day in, that day in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill JFK, and the book will be coming out soon. I think it was supposed to be coming out in May, but now it's coming out in June. But we decided during the break, Robert, that pretty much we could listen to you tell us stories like every day. We're just going to change our show. We're going to call it the Robert Tannenbaum Show and just have you on every week. We'll be like,
you guys are great.
We'll be like, hi, this is Aaron and Bill. Robert's telling us a story. Everybody be quiet.
Because
you know what? It's like, I don't know about you, but in growing up in the 60s, I mean, we listened to our relatives tell us stories. When we'd go to my grandma's house, we would just sit there and the relatives would all just tell stories. We didn't watch TV. We didn't watch ball games. We didn't do any of that stuff. We listened to them tell us stories. And I don't know. I don't know that we do that so much. But as a, I think humans are hardwired for stories. You know, we're just.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned the grandmothers. I lived at first 12 years of my life in Brooklyn, shared a bedroom with my brother, who's 4 years older than I, and every Friday night, I would go with my mother and my aunt, my mother's younger sister, to my grandma's house, my mother's mother, and it was her apartment in a brownstone, and we would have dinner every Friday night together, and I attribute this to what I'm about to tell you to my grandmother. And that is, you never know where you're going to learn certain things, and things happen that affect your life.
Yeah.
One of which was, of course, the great love and affection and all the kinds of things that, you know, I was helping my grandma do whatever she asked me to do with respect to, you know, putting in the bread into the oven and the egg sauce around it so we had sprinkles on it and so on and so forth. And, in other words, the least amount of expertise to do anything. But it was so much fun being with her. And she said to me one day, and this is, you know, going through ages like 5 to 7, 8 years old, she said to me, Bobby, you got to stop doing what you're doing. And I was eating. And I said, well, what is the matter, Grandma? She said, you're eating with your left hand. And I said, yes, I'm a lefty. She said, no, only the Germans eat with their left hand.
Oh.
I said, what? Yeah. I said, what? And I couldn't think of anything less, you know, important than how I ate, you know, with my left hand. And she said, no, the Germans eat with your left hand. You can't do that. Well, as a result of that, what I'm about to tell you is true. I did everything then with my right hand, and including playing ball. And to this day, and when I was playing ball, I would receive the inbound pass and start off my dribble going down court with my right hand. And then flipping that ball over to what we called a crossover back in the day.
Yeah.
And then power the person at the top of the key, the top of the foul line area, and just power them with my left hand and what we called the crossover dribble. And I get a kick out of it because, but for that, I would have been strictly a left-handed player. Dribble, shoot, and the whole routine. But because she was so emphatic about it, and the last thing I would ever want to do is have my grandmother disappointed in me.
Yeah.
And my mother never made an issue about it at all. I mean, you know, it was never even a close question about anything like that. But I was so, which is why it was so strange for her to say something like that, and I sure as heck wasn't going to disappoint her. But here it is, a simple thing of going to grandma's house for Friday night dinner. And, you know, my brother and I were huge eaters. I was like 180 pounds then, 6'5". When I was in high school. But, you know, when someone says a cookie fell on the floor, I'm not going to eat it. In my house, the cookie never made it to the floor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
My drink,
I'm the oldest of five kids. No cookies made it to our floor either.
That's exactly right. So anyway, I got a kick out of you mentioning grandma. That to me is really warms the cockles of my heart, as I will tell you.
It's true, anyway, though. You know, we always listened to the stories, you know, and mm-hmm. and so my younger brothers and sisters to this day will say, "How do you know that?" I'm like, because they told the story like 100 times. Like,
exactly. Yeah,
what were you
exactly
in the womb?
Right. Oh yeah, you were.
My kids say that to me. Oh, yeah, we only heard this 100 times.
Right.
Did I say this to you? Did I tell you this? This guy, you know, this is what blah 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 blah. Anyway.
It is kind of funny, and as you, my last aunt just died a week ago, and so now I have one uncle and a cousin, and then I'm the third oldest person in our family, and it's like, all of a sudden you feel kind of this pressure, you know? Yikes.
I know the other guys don't know
any of these stories, like maybe I better write it down.
This is it. It's so much a treasure in our lives. To have that opportunity, it's not something shared by that, every year. I think it gets less and less, but to have that privilege, which I consider that to be wonderful, just sitting there listening. Because my grandmother would come over on Saturday nights and sit by my bed, and I'm 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, and regale me with stories.
Yeah,
not just the typical stuff. But stories that she would make up, and she was some storyteller. And so when you think about all these things, and the only thing that I do remember without question was the sweat coming off my head into my bed because we had no air conditioning.
Trust me, I grew up in Connecticut sweating just like you. Yeah,
and we had no fan, no AC.
I know. I don't know how much fans were. I laugh about that to this day. We had one fan. It was in my two brothers shared a room. It was in their room at the end of the hall. There was like a draw fan in the window that made, it was like if an ant was blowing air on you, it was about that much air came out my window.
Exactly.
And you're laying in your bed, and it's like, it's so horrible. There was no air conditioning in school or home or car or anywhere.
Exactly. Exact mundo.
Yeah.
But you know what? We made it. We made it.
Yeah, and we played sports then. Like, I played field hockey, and we played outdoor sports in the summertime, uh-huh. And you think, I don't know, that would probably be considered, cruel and inhuman. While I was laughing at the beginning of the hour, the environmentalist here canceled their Earth Day celebration because they thought it might rain. I was like, oh boy, civilization's almost over.
Totally. That's exactly right. What I love are about the climate people. The world has already ended several times. They got to go back to the drawing boards on that one.
Yeah, Bill keeps pretty close track of Al Gore's list, and we regularly mock him. But mocking is another skill that we've tried to ban, but it's not really taking. And thank God President Trump came back with, a little New York spice, some mocking, and some terrific, names. The name calling I really miss. I don't know, maybe it's an East Coast thing with the name calling.
Yeah, without question. I mean, thank God for him. That's all I have to say. And I can't imagine what we would be doing with respect to him not being president now.
Yep.
And what I also think is that Elon Musk, in this process of revealing the corruption, now we know how Biden has 3 houses on the beach in Delaware.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the president to get involved with his team and let us know how it is that all of this is, that we've always talked about, generally speaking, once we started telling stories on Saturday nights, that how do you make all this, how do you make $100,000 a year, let's say, as an elected official and wind up with 3 houses on the beach?
Yeah.
And we know the answer. We know the answer. But what I want the public to know is that the money that has allegedly gone under this, the rubric of, guess what? This is where the money went to. And these absurd places, absurd things that had nothing to do, with anything rational, because the money never went there. the money went directly. The elected officials, in my judgment, glommed the money. Period. They never put it to these crazy things that the table of contents make you just shake your head, and you can't stop shaking your head. You got to put two hands on your head so your head doesn't fall off.
But isn't it amazing that you have people that are just absolutely hysterical that they're looking into all of this? And I'm thinking,
I don't understand what they're thinking.
Yeah,
what? They think it's okay to be corrupt? Is that what the Democrat Party is now?
I don't know, but I might be or might not be tormenting, you know, maybe some liberal people in my neighborhood with small garden flags that I hang out front, and I might have accidentally found one yesterday that says, "Even my dog loves Elon." It might be showing up on Wednesday, and I can't wait to put it out. I don't understand. How do you defend all of that? It seems... I bet you feel like you woke up every now and then in a world that you don't recognize.
Without question. It is so disturbing. And when you have a guy like Moss, the world's richest man, and I'd like to know what his interest income is for a month. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, get out of here. This is ridiculous. And people want to take him on and be nasty. And, you know, the guy can hire 100 lawyers at the flip of a coin. You know, you'll have them all over the lot, like ants, you know, sprawling around the kitchen or somewhere. So, anyway, back to let me finish this off for you.
Yeah, sorry.
I just don't want to keep it open-ended. No, that's all right. I'm just saying that what happened was the government then decided, you know, that this was not so and so on and so forth. And what happened was I certainly looked into it with its authenticity, and it's 1,000% accurate. That is... The McCone, the response to Rowley's request of John McCone, head of the CIA, and in that response, which is dated March 3rd, 64, he talks about that while the persons involved in the assassination worked for this agency, the CIA, and he goes on and, you know, saying that it's impossible to maintain a full 24-hour day responsibility over its operatives, is such a, you know, it's so hideous. And that what I did was, in some of the research, was this goes back to a researcher who, during the House, in 1978, as I mentioned early on, in 1977, in January, Sprague and I started our investigation of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And in 4 months, the government decided that we had gone too far, and that's when I left off and telling you, I said to Lou Stokes, why'd you hire me? And he said, the truth is that the majority, and he always kept himself out of this thing, Lou, and he said the majority didn't think you'd get to this dirty mess with the evidence you've amassed so soon, if at all. So I just stared at him, and he said, well, what's your next move? It's like a chess game we're playing here. I was invited down to do something. Sprague and I were doing it. They promised they wouldn't interfere, and now they're totally destroying it. And I said, I will tell you right now, as I lean forward on my desk, on my club chair here in your office, looking you squarely in the eye and tell you, I officially resign right now. I don't want anything to do with this investigation from this point on. And as I left the office, his office, I said, I turned to him and I said, does this include Richard Sprague as well? And he said, yes, absolutely. I said, good. I'm sure Sprague will have a word or two to talk to you about. And I went and I talked to Dick and I told him what happened. So what's important here is that in 78, during the House Select Committee on Assassinations, a key member, an extremely credible member of the staff, discovered the copy of this document. This document of what we call the McCone document, of the March 3rd, 64 document. And having found this copy of the document, and he took it from the Oswald file at the end of the investigation. And there's also a video confessional confirming this. But also the letter was mentioned in a book by Dick Russell, who's a very respectable research person. Look, a lot of the people who are researchers are off the charts somewhere, flying around the universe. But there are also a lot of good people. Dick Russell is one of those people, in my judgment. And he wrote a book called The Man Knew Too Much in 1991, and he mentioned this whole letter. And then there's a gentleman called Malcolm Blunt. And I mention this to you because the government, the claims they make are totally off the wall. No evidence, ever, and the evidence is to the contrary, as I stated initially. There's this fellow, Malcolm Blunt. He's known as the best qualified archive document researcher. And he said, I have no problem verifying the McCone Rally document. Everything on it is heading and file numbers are official and were used before McCone's connotation and is similar to other memos. The only thing to maybe question is the signature. It looks like a copy. However, the copy to the public is from a copy, if that makes sense. So anyway, the point is, it's a legitimate document. It's a shocking document. And no matter how they play it, it's not going to go away. So then, let's get us into the following, really, right now.
Hold that before, so I don't have to cut you off in the middle. I don't know what it is. Do you find that time in your world goes faster? Because when you're with us, time goes faster.
Well, I want to tell you something. Not only does it go faster, I believe there's probably a conspiracy somewhere.
Yes!
Every day is Friday here.
That's what's happening. Oh, my God. It's just bizarre. Yeah, all right. Our guest is Robert Tannenbaum, the time traveler. You have to write a new book about that. And he is here with us at We the People. And we have got the previous show we did with him, which was only an hour. Imagine how much we got covered there. And then this show. And then, of course, we'll have future shows. So we'll add those on here as well. You can find him at wethepeopleradio.us.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place. Even your emotions had an echo in so much space. And when you're out there without care, yeah, I was out of touch. But it wasn't because I didn't know enough. I just knew too much.
With a plain and simple dream. Wanna infiltrate some third world place and topple their regime. Those men in black with their mansion suitcases, where everything's on a need-to-know basis. Agents got that swagger, everyone's so cloak and dagger. I'm feeling nervous, but I'm really kinda wishing for an undercover mission. That's when the red alert came on the radio, and I put my earpiece on. Got my dark sunglasses on, and I had my weapon drawn. So I get my handcuffs, my cyanide pills, my classified dossier. Coming the phones like, yeah. Shredding the files like, yeah. I memorized all the enemy's spies. I gotta neutralize today. Yeah. It's a party in the CIA.
Had to be said.
Robert, I feel like we know you well enough. We can play some Weird Al now. We can come clean now.
I'm with you.
All right. Back to the story.
Okay, here we go. I want you to mention a place where you can get testimony that I've given, and that was in the JFK Records Act of 1992. That was sort of done as a result of what Stone was doing with the movie JFK. He puts in a tremendous amount of information. It's almost impossible if you haven't been studying this to really get what he's out there for. I mean, I told Stone I hate his politics. He's an American hater. But he put out as much evidence as you can get into this film. It's all scrambled out, but it's there. And again, you'd only recognize it if you had done this kind of exercise that we're doing over a period of time. But in 1993, they created the Assassination Record Review Board, and they asked me to testify in front of it. And it happened to be from a district court judge who was the chair of it, I believe from Minnesota. And what's going on with Minnesota? That's another story, I'll tell you that one. But anyway, this fellow would seem to be a very, very decent gentleman, district court judge, and he asked if I would testify. I said, oh, you know, ask me any questions you want, and I'll be delighted to give you answers, assuming that they're highly relevant to what's going on here. I don't have any secrets. And so I gave testimony, and the basic line of the testimony was what they should do with all these documents. And I said back then, give over everything. The public has the absolute right to see what happened here with the JFK case. And don't tell me they can't handle the truth. Please, please, please. You know, it would make great movie moment if you can't handle the truth stuff. So I did this, and it's all right there for you to read if you're so interested in that. And
this is at the National Archives in the
yes.
Okay,
exactly.
I'm putting the link up as we speak.
It's the Assassination Record Review Board, 1993, and what happened is that I'm still going to answer this question, by the way, about why I wrote this book. I haven't forgotten it. Trust me. And if we have to stay for the next 3 hours, I'll do it for you, believe me.
This is anyway. Great. This is like the leave behind, and then we can just do it all again, because we're totally
exactly.
up for it.
Oh, you're great. You're great. Anyway, what happened then was, to show you how the government, and we're going to get to the truth of Daily Plaza in a second, but I did want to mention something to you about the nature of the lies that the government talks about. And they know they're lying. And if you get a page 37 of the Forensic Medical Panel report, dated in and around August/78, page 37 of the Forensic Medical Panel report of 8/78. This is when the committee, Sprague and I, were not there. And by the way, when we left, the first persons that were hired by this fellow who took over, a professor type, never tried a case in his life or investigated a murder case. Perfect to get your teeth into that, you know, by taking over this case. And he wrote in his report the following in substance. Parkland doctors have been mistaken about seeing an avulsive head wound because all 26 witnesses at Bethesda during the autopsy did not see the head injury. Now keep in mind, JFK's head is hit from the right front in the Knoll Hill area, in the stockade fence, and it snaps back and to the left. That's what we see. That's what we see. It's not what I'm telling you. It's the way that's what we see in the film.
Right.
It said snaps back and to the left and rests in Mrs. Kennedy's right shoulder. And so let me repeat that. The Parkland doctors must have been mistaken when they saw the avulsive head wound, because all the 26 witnesses at Bethesda during the autopsy did not see the head injury. All 26 Bethesda witnesses saw the gaping hole in the back of the president's head. And they also get this. Not only did they see the gaping hole, but they notified the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And page 37 is part of that report. You know what happens when you get this kind of evidence in a case? This coupled also with the McCone letter, the McCone document. You look up heavenly and you say, thank you, God. I can take over from here. That's what it's like when you try these cases, because they're so overwhelming in what happened. Now let's quickly go to the Daily Plaza, the truth. Remember, keep in mind, the government says three shots from the back, from the stockade, from the depository window, and one hit the president in the back with a downward track, which is very important here. And the other one hit him in the head. Here's what happened. There were not three shots. There were five shots. And what's amazing about it is when you try so many cases as I had and so on, you don't wait for a witness to come forward and say, hey, what? You know, I saw Bob Tannenbaum there, and I can make a positive identification. He had a pistol in his hand kind of thing. That's not what this is about when you talk to witnesses at a scene. And what did the witnesses say? There were two flurries, they said. We think there were three, t- two or three shots in the first flurry. And Kennedy and Connolly were both hit in the back. Keep in mind, Kennedy was hit with a downward track, according to what we see. And they said it happened very fast, the witnesses said, of these two or three shots. Well, what they didn't know was I was able to go frame by frame, and it was 2.6 seconds. The entire shooting sequence is about 8.3 seconds.
Holy.
Struck Kennedy and Connolly in the back. And then the witnesses said it was a pause. The pause was 4.8 seconds. They didn't know that. Then, on this downward track, the Zapruder film shows at frame Z, as in Zapruder, 313. This is a critical, critical frame. It's the fourth shot, causing a boom blast from the right front Knoll Hill stockade fence area in close proximity to where Zapruder was filming. It struck Kennedy in his right temple, above his right ear, and it caused his head to snap back violently. And he left him basically immobile, bodily depressed, and slumped dead in Mrs. Kennedy's shoulder. Now, why is that so important? When this happened, the government ran into a big problem. And the problem was the following. They claimed that the murder weapon, as you may recall, was the Mandelkot Carcano rifle. And now keep in mind, the Parkland doctors, like the chief of neurosurgery, was in charge. He observed the gaping hole in the back of the prisoner's head. And he said it's to the lower right occipital bone area in the back of our head, if you put your hand in the back of your head. And I saw the cerebellum, said Dr. Clark. Robert McClellan, who's a doctor at Parkland, drafted this vivid diagram depicting the gaping hole in the back of the prisoner's head. None of these witnesses were called by the Warren Commission. Why is that? And in addition, Dr. Robert Shaw was a thoracic surgeon who handled Connolly's thoracic wounds. And what he said was, as you know, when you see an autopsy being done, the doctor is speaking into a microphone just to get all the facts down. And within an hour or so, the government had a lot of information. And some of the information was the following. Robert Shaw said that there was a 27-degree declination, a bullet in the downward track that was an in-and-out wound. And that track to Connolly and to Kennedy, both of them, the 27-degree declination from the rooftop at the County Records Building in the northeast corner of Elm Street. Remember that car making a left-hand turn onto Elm, the limo, was going northbound on Houston, and then made the left onto Elm. It was directly to the rear of the president's limo to the point of entry in Connolly's back. Let me repeat that. Shaw found and noted that there was a 27-degree declination from the bullet wound suffered by Kennedy and Connolly. Well, they also then checked the County Records Building in the northeast corner of Elm Street. And that's right next to the book depository, which is on Elm Street. And the declination was 27 degrees from the rooftop of the County Records Building to the rear of the president's building to the point of entry into Connolly's back. Now, people want to talk about a second shooter. Here you have a situation where the people involved in this investigation realized that there was more to this thing than they thought about. And here we have, from the County Records Building, it's a clean shot right down Elm Street. There's no interference with shrubbery or any angles. And right from the rooftop to the point of entry to the rear of the limo in Connolly's back was 27 degrees. Okay, now, with respect to a problem that surfaced in this thing, the following occurred. In December of 63, the Secret Service and the FBI found that Connolly and JFK were struck by two separate bullets. Two separate bullets, and both were shot within 1.9 seconds of each other. Well, what do you think about that? Here's what you think about it. The manual bolt action necessary to fire separate successive shots from the alleged murder weapon, the Mannlicher-Carcano rifle, takes 2.3 seconds. Let me repeat that. Kennedy and Connolly were struck by two separate bullets within, they were hit within 1.9 seconds. In order for that Mannlicher-Carcano rifle to fire separate successive shots from the Mannlicher-Carcano takes 2.3 seconds. What does that tell us? The Mannlicher-Carcano, which the government has alleged for 62 years is the murder weapon, could not have fired both shots. So what happened?
And you knew that at the time.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So the CIA then ordered, get this, Arlen Specter, who was a politico then in Philadelphia. This is before he became DA and a senator. Let me just say his politics were, when he ran for a DA in Philly, he was a Democrat. When he ran statewide to get the Pittsburgh vote, one could suggest, he ran, this is a state senator, United States senator, he ran as a Republican. But the CIA then knew that he would help them out, if you will. And they directed him to come up with the one bullet theory. Now, what is that? This theory is a sham, a fabrication, and scientifically invalid. Why? Because of the following. I repeat now for at least a third time that the shot that hit Connolly and JFK in the back was a downward track. This one bullet theory, as conceived in March of 64 by Specter, said that the bullet that was traveling at 1,800 feet per second from the rifle, according to what the government says, had to move upward. Remember the downward track I keep talking about here? The bullet was in a downward track, meaning its point of entry was above the point of exit, or would have been above the point of exit had it been an exit. So the question is, how does this bullet get out from the throat of JFK? The one bullet theory. And what the government has laid out is that, notwithstanding the fact that this was a downward track in JFK's body, that the track became vertical. It moved upward 11 degrees. Imagine this. You understand what I'm just telling you here? That the bullet it stopped its downwardness and miraculously came up and spent itself out the throat of Kennedy and struck Connolly in the rib and fractured his axial nerve in his right wrist. And only in this case can a bullet that is moving downward, because the bullet was at least 5 to 6 inches below the neckline, and it was downward. Again, the point, meaning the point is higher at entry and lower at the downward track area. And that bullet, then, they claim, the government claimed this. They still do. And they say that, well, you know what happened? The bullet moved up 11 degrees straight up towards his throat, exited his throat, struck Connolly in the ribs, and fractured his axial nerve, and severed the tendon between his right thumb and his index finger on the right hand. So, now, the positive evidence in the case is what we call minute metallic fragments. What are they? These we see in the three skull x-rays, which I implore you to see. It's a long, narrow rectangle. And it shows the path, the direction of the minute metallic fragments. Now, what are they? If I was shot in the back of the head right now, there would be no minute metallic fragments above my right ear, as was the case with JFK, where he was struck initially. How do we know that? Because not only does the framing of the minute metallic fragments in this rectangular, which is superimposed, these x-rays are superimposed on JFK's head, is that the three skull x-rays show a gray cloud near the center of the fragment trail, and it extends across the top of the skull, the fourth shot. And it tells us the direction and the point of entry of the fourth shot, which to this day our government never mentions. And so you know what they did? They gelatinized 10 skeletons as to have the same substance of a real skull. and they shot at the same height and distance as at the book depository nonsense. And guess what happened? They hit the skulls, and what they were and the skulls were hit from the back. And which direction do you think the skulls moved? Quick answer: they moved forward.
Mm-hmm.
If someone came in and hit me with a bat in the side of my front head, of my head would move to the left side. Keep in mind when you analyze all this, from what I'm chatting with you about, the head has moved the body all the time with respect to the force applied to it. It's not the body moving and the head moving on along. It's not that at all. The head is moving the body because of the shots to the head and everything that else happened with respect to the head in this case. So that tells us what the problem was and what they thought would be the explanation for this. And what they did was, the government, it was even more pernicious.
Hold that thought, Robert. I hate to cliffhanger you, but if we don't take a break, we'll be at the end of the hour, and then I'll be in trouble. So, quick break. Right back. Our guest is Robert Tannenbaum, and you're listening to We the People Radio.
.us.
I was born six gun in my hand. Behind a gun, I make my final stand. Hey, it's why they call me Bad Company, but I can deny it.
Back to Robert. Our guest is Robert Tannenbaum. So we've got the government hid the fourth shot. They did some tests from the depository, which everybody kind of figured out a long time ago that didn't make sense. Did they think people were really going to buy it? Like in real time, when you were looking at this, was it like, what the heck? No one's going to believe this. Uh-oh.
The positive evidence is so overwhelming. For example, I give you a quick aside here is that there's another doctor, Dr. Charles Gregory, who was checking out fragments that hit Connolly's wrist and were removed for comparison with the so-called magic bullet. That is Commission Exhibit CE-399, this pristine bullet, allegedly. And Connolly's wound shattered his wrist, as I mentioned, his radial nerve, and cut the tendon, fully leading to his right hand. And remember, he was holding this Stetson hat, if you recall, and you see it in the film, and he was holding it like upside down. All he had to do was, with his right hand, is flip it up and put it on. And throughout all the shooting, as a major piece of corroboration, he never dropped the Stetson hat until he was hit with the fragment that became what we call the fifth shot. And that was the shot that hit Kennedy in the cowlick area above his, in the back of his head. And it would happen 7/10 of a second after the fourth shot. And I had worked with a photographic expert consultant, Bob Groden, and at frame 255, you see, it's so helpful to have all these frames, because in frame 255, we see no damage to the windshield. What's the significance of that? It tells us that the first flurry happened between frames 224 and 230. And we did not detect a flare that we detected at frame 313. That's the shot that hit Kennedy in the head and blew the back of his head off. And that's what the Parkland doctors were talking about, the damage that he suffered in the back of his head being blown off. So the fourth shot killed him. And what was the substance of the third shot? The third shot, I maintain that we should see a flare in the film, as we see it at 313, and we should see it basically at frame 328. And that's the fifth shot, 0.7 seconds after the fourth shot. And what we did was we went frame by frame. And in going frame by frame, we did away with the government's other major lie, and that was called neutron activation analysis, NAA, N as in Nancy, AA, neutron activation analysis, which is alleged to be the principal testing component of CBLA, comparative bullet lead analysis, CBLA. And the only government, the only lab that did any of this testing was the government. Now, what was the testing they were doing? They were claiming that there were two bullets, really, in this whole case. And this is what NAA proves, they say. And what does that mean? It means that the shots that were fired were analyzed as neutron activation analysis. Remember, the principal testing components were comparative bullet lead analysis. And they claimed there were two large fragments in the limo. They came from one bullet. That's one bullet. Because the fragments match fragments, they said. And this is science that's talking about here. And then the Connolly removal of fragments to the so-called magic bullet, the pristine bullet, you can match fragments to a bullet. Well, no one bothered to speak to the real experts. These were the PhDs in metallurgy. Every one of them that was spoken to that I'm aware of said that you cannot compare a fragment to a fragment. That goes the whole thing in the window, in the limo, that there was that one bullet that fragmented and they matched each other. Can't do it. And that you can't match a fragment to a bullet. And that's the bullet, the pristine bullet, that they're matching with respect to NAA. So they went around bragging. They have testing here. If you don't believe the science of this case, they argued, you believe the Earth is flat. This is literally what they said. So Bob Groder and I went through frame by frame of all these hits, and we concluded the following based upon what we observed. We finally saw the flare at frame 328. You see? 328. And that was the fragment impact revealed in the fifth shot that hit Connolly, that hit JFK in the cowl at the top of his head, and it caused his head to move forward. And it enlarged the wound of the fourth shot. And you see the damage to the interior, what I call the flare, at frame 328, that there's damage to the limo interior windshield, to the left of the rearview mirror. And the last fragment hit Connolly's right wrist and severed the tendon in his hand, the axial nerve in his wrist, and caused him to drop the Stetson hat. Every expert you speak to about this case, who knows anything about anything, understands what I just told you, and you don't have to be an expert to figure all this stuff out. It's right there in front of you. And particularly when we see the flare, again, to the interior of the limo windshield, to the left of the rearview mirror. And so that, in large measure, is what the government has done here. I mean, this NAA thing, this neutron activation analysis, is the ultimate ending of their lying. And too bad in the sense that we have enough lies from the government.
Yeah.
The problem with this case is, I consider it the most important case in criminal justice in American history. Why do I say that grandiose comment? Because we know who killed Lincoln, unfortunately. I say unfortunately, I'm talking about the fact that Abraham Lincoln is an incredible human being sent by God. Believe me, I believe that. This man, uneducated man, I want you to know. He was murdered, and we know where and when. We do not know who in Dealey Plaza murdered the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy. It's heartbreaking. And the government is part and parcel of the lie. That's the presentation that I think you were waiting for me to give you. I hope it was. Because that's all I got left in the engine right now.
That's a great point, because we don't know who the shooters were.
Exactly.
Do you think that's why they waited so long?
Well, I mean, they can wait all they want. It's embarrassing, though, isn't it? For me to tell you, hey, we're waiting for some. We're waiting for a piece of ammo from Evident. What? They've lied to this day for 62 years.
Yeah.
You think maybe they washed, and you think maybe you had someone. You had Miss Ellen Ryan, who testified hypothetically, and that you know what they've done based upon the information I have. They decided they didn't like what you said in your testimony, so they changed your testimony but kept your name. That's what's going on here with this CIA nonsense. And it's the worst. It's the worst. It has nothing to do with Elon Musk and all the good things he's trying to do. You can't have the government run by bureaucrats who are not elected people. It's one thing for the agency people to make recommendations to whether it's Article 1 or Article 2. That's fine. That's what it's all about. And they make their recommendations to the president about national security and other important issues. But not to have someone just do whatever the hell they want, create their own... there's a case, Raimondo. Is that the case? It was recently a case that the Supreme Court handled that talked about this very issue, that the government has no business permitting agencies to make rules, which is like legislation, because it's a violation of Article 1. They're making legislation up, and they have not been elected to do that. And they have sanctions. If you violate their rules, they have sanctions. Well, who gave them that authority? Lazy members of the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And if you want to know about oversight, I'll leave you with this. The great Chuckie Schumer, the senator from New York, unfortunately, said about President Trump when he took on the executive intelligence agencies, wanted to know some answers to things. What did Schumer say? This is chief of oversight in the United States Senate. He says, I thought that, Trump was a savvy guy. Well, no one savvy or smart is going to take on the executive intelligence agencies because they got 8 ways to Sunday to get back at you.
Yep.
Yeah.
And nothing but time.
And when I told Lou Stokes about the notion of why did you hire me routine, I was basically referring in my mind to the attitude of the government. And that is that they decide who to hand off to try and keep their distance if there's any flack. And no one is raising the points that were just mentioned by the United States Supreme Court, that having unelected officials get involved in legislation and in sanctions for violation of their own legislation, which is a violation of the First Amendment. They should all be reminded in Washington the First Amendment is with respect to legislation. It has to do with legislation. And the people we want legislation to be done by and for are the legislators who are elected for the people. God knows the havoc they make with respect to what they do and they don't do. So that's about the story and its limitations. I would have hoped everybody goes to Amazon right now and gets at least 5 books on delivery.
They should.
That's what's going on. The book, everything I've mentioned to you in detail is in my book, That Day in Dallas. Oswald Did Not Kill the President. So I would urge, people, if you're really interested in this, please get my book. I lay it all out for you. And I have exhibits that are dynamite, wonderful exhibits, that pictorially tell you the story. And all these different frames that I refer to, frame 313, where you see the president's head getting blown off. Someone should ask the whole Warren Commission, how come you didn't put on any of these Parkland doctors? And why aren't you told the American public that his head snapped back? When's the last time someone got shot in the back of the head and his head went backwards?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think we all learned that, in fifth grade in science?
Something like that.
That's terrible. Like that.
Anyway, I do want to thank you guys for giving me this chance to expound upon these facts. It's very important as far as I'm concerned.
It's super important. And there's a lot of noise out there about this topic. I've listened to a lot of different interviews, usually briefly because they're silly and boring and don't have any detail, and your info is awesome and helpful. So we are going to talk about some of your other books on a different day. But can you believe it? We're out of time. I know, what a shock. But Robert Tannenbaum, you can come and tell us a story absolutely any day. Well, any Sunday. How about that? Because that's the only day we're here.
All right. Yeah, I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much. We will chat with you again. So if you have missed this or you want to send it to a friend, you can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.